Say I've always had trouble with these first few words, and I thought I had gotten away from that about 2 years ago. It's just come back to me. I guess I'm a little bemused by a poster that I saw here that has me playing in this place in 73 when it was called something else. I can almost remember that. They used to ask me in interviews what I would do if this all fell through. And I used to think, why are you asking me that? No, I don't think about that. I mean, now they ask me if I think it was worth it, and the stuff, the questions like that. I did an interview with a 12-year-old girl in Madison, Wisconsin, a couple weeks ago. I'll tell you about that later. At one point she asked me as I should have suspected, and I'd been forewarned that I was being interviewed by a 12-year-old. When I heard that, I asked, and they, my management called and said, this is a 12-year-old girl who's doing this interview. Do you want to do this? And I said, well, ask the management if she's mean. Because I know from personal experience, they can be just, and there's, what can you do to retaliate with a 12-year-old child? You can't. I said, no, she's tractable and polite. And I should have guessed that the interview would be about my childhood, What did I know I'd be doing this when I grew up? Did I plan to do this? How much did I practice? It was that sort of thing. And why was I doing this? And I couldn't think of an answer for that until, there really isn't any. You don't know why you do anything. I don't. I hope nobody knows. What a horrible world, Sort of a because kind of life. But I remembered talking to her that the first concert I'd ever seen was Spike Jones, who was a guy that had a band made up of plumbing fixtures, basically. People who would come out and play elbow pipes and lint traps and plungers and things like that, with the occasional trombone thrown in. And it was virtuosity of a high order, but it was hard to tell because, you know, you have the feeling that anybody could play a lint trap. And I, at the time, I was a violin player. I was 8 years old. It was my first concert, and I had been exposed up to that point to the things that my grandmother had on records, into what I'd been forced to play on the violin. And when I saw this band, I thought, this is not good. This is, I was an eight-year-old, fully developed, totally grown snob, and I couldn't understand what these clowns were doing, especially Spike Jones, who conducted from his wrist down here. It's the only thing that moved. There's just this stick with a kind of tablecloth suit on it and a kind of a huge Trent Lott sort of head on his shoulders. You just stand there, and it bothered me. I didn't like it. There's no violins in the orchestra. And then a guy ran across the front of the stage. This was in a gymnasium in Cheyenne, Wyoming, with a clarinet through his head. And, you know, it was a peak experience for me. I clearly remember thinking, I want to be him. You know, and here I am. And so I said this to the 12-year-old girl, whose name was Clara, who every time she asked me a question, she'd brought an adult with her to keep me in line, I think, who would say things like, that's good, that was a follow-up question. God. And so I told her, you know, and I the guy with the clarinet, and I wanted to be him. And she looked at me and she said, what were your major influences? And he said, that was a follow-up question. That was good. I wasn't going to tell you any of that. I think it's time for a ballad. Now I have to tell you about this. There are guys, Bert Camford being one of them, who either wrote this or arranged it. It's hard to tell. Leroy Anderson being another, who have a talent for dreaming up a hook. They can get a hook about this long that you'll hear once and never forget for the rest of your life. And it's generally something that I like. But this ability, and it's something they're born with, I think, can be put to an evil end. And then we're all in trouble. I met the guy, and that's how I got into this. I met the guy about the time I played here for the first time, was it 73? I met the guy who wrote Yummy, 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 I've Got Love in My Tummy. A guy named Reed Whitelaw. I met him, but I didn't hurt him. And anyhow, this one I don't mind so much. It sounds to me a lot better on a guitar. Oops, excuse me, a little punchy there. Thank you. Same ballpark. It's been a hit three times. Written by Eddie Reeves and Alex Harvey for two friends of theirs who are getting married. And the friends are still speaking to them, but not to each other.
Stand upon the sand with the preacher band. Let the
wedding bells ring.
Thank you.
Depressed man in show business. I saw him recently in Maryland. The last time. Just a minute. I'm sitting. I'm like, there. Where was I? The last time I saw him was probably over 20 years ago, and he was really depressed. He was opening for me in New York State somewhere, and crammed into the corner of a dressing room and. Looked really bleak, what I could see of him, but this time he showed up at a show in Maryland, and he's a baker, and he's beaming, and he's one of the happiest people I think I've seen in the last year, and he hasn't touched a guitar in a decade, probably, because the source of his despair was the stage. He hated going on stage, and that's a handicap in show business. But he's delighted now. You notice there's no support tonight. I try not to I don't like having support acts because they're either just too awful or too good to follow. And it's the terrible ones that are really impossible. I mean, because if they're good, you can have a good time. But if they're terrible, I saw another Heap. The only other Heap I've seen resembling the Heap that Paul Siebel, that was his name, could approximate. I've forgotten the front of this sentence, but I know how it ends. In Buffalo, New York, I walked down in the dressing room, and there was another Heap. Looked just like Paul, only he was facing out of the corner instead of in. It looked, and I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "I just got back from my." And wait a minute, I just got back from my vacation. And I said, "Really? Are you okay?" He said, "Well, I said, where'd you go on your vacation?" And he said, "Hanoi." Wow. Club Hanoi. And I said, what'd you go there for? And he wouldn't answer the question. Instead, he said, "I have malaria." He said, it's like acid. It just keeps coming back and back. So showtime rolled around, and the guy came down and said, "You're on," and he headed for the stage, and I was right behind him because I didn't want to miss this. And he walked out, sat down, and he hit one of these, let me see, one of these notes. And there's this kind of silence, and he leaned into the mic and said, "I have malaria." Oh boy, am I glad we came here tonight. How do you follow that? They said that Louise was not half bad. It was written on the walls and window shade. And though she'd act the little girl, a deceiver. Her trade. bottle of perfume. Flowers and maybe some lace. Men brought Louise 10-cent trinkets. Their intentions were easily traced. And everybody knew at times she cried. Thank you. about 9 weeks ago, I broke my foot, that foot, and I was jumping my own security fence in Oregon at a concert, and they had fenced me in. There was no gate in the fence, and it offended me, I guess. I got kind of precious about it. I didn't have anywhere to go, but I went there anyhow, cause just, you know, on general principle, and I jumped a fence, and it was a Potemkin fence, you know. It was a fake fence, and it looked like a fence, but it was just something held together with foam rubber lining, sort of insert things, and so it wouldn't support my weight. I went up in the air, and the first thing the audience saw of me that day was flying through the air and landing in an awkward position on my foot and subsequent parts of myself. The foot was the only thing that broke. I went out and played an hour later, because you hear it break, but you don't know, you don't think that you broke something. I don't know why. You'd think you might have a suspicion. Well, I had a suspicion, but, you know, it didn't hurt that much yet. And after I'd stood on it for an hour, I couldn't walk anymore. And so I'm not standing up anymore when I play. I've learned that I really would prefer to sit down. I'd prefer to lay down if I could get away with it. I had a plan at one time to appear on a gurney, my own gurney with an IV hooked up to it. I mean, there's, you know, those guys who squeeze themselves into the corner have, you know, they might have something. And so after breaking my foot, I had the chance, actually, to do this, because I couldn't sit like that, like this, like that. I couldn't stand on it. And but I didn't do it. I didn't hire a guy to push me around, because I had tried that a long time ago, thinking that it was incumbent upon a professional to have a roadie, forgetting that there's only one of me and that I travel by myself and there's nothing for him to do. And it's just like hiring an irritant. That's really what it is. Because, you know, you can't, it takes about 5 minutes and you hate each other. I mean, what are you going to, you know, it doesn't work. And if there's three people traveling together, then it can work, because, you know, whoever the asshole is can just get ignored for the day. But if it's just two of you, there's always. I hired a guy. This was part of the problem, is I'm too cheap to hire somebody who'd done it before or knew anything about it. So I hired a microbiologist to be my my roadie, and he insisted that all microbiologists are unemployable. Once you get trained and have your degree and are available, there's nothing you can do. He's convinced still of that. He has yet to be employed as a microbiologist, and so he went to work for me, and he would leave notes, one of them that I remember, for example, on the mayonnaise backstage when there was catering, that said, "Beware Staphylococcus aureus." And you'd see, you know, and he knew all kinds of, obviously, things like that, that you were happier not knowing. And once he told you, it got to be a deadly profession. But he was, so I didn't, you know, so I just canceled 8 jobs. I knew better than to think I could travel around with and by the way, if you want to go nuts, go break one bone and sit in a motel for 3 days. That's all it takes. It's all it takes for me. Maybe I'm a wimp. And, of course I'm a wimp. I mean, why be anything else, really? Anyhow, I've canceled 8 jobs and escaped, you know, anybody saying, "Well, you don't play with your feet, play with your hands." You know, it didn't happen. And this is a tune. Well, when I was working with Bill, he would, he was the guy who pointed out one night, because when you're done playing, you go back to the hotel and you play some more, because you've been playing, and you sit around and you play and until the phone rings. And Mr. Cote, we've been getting complaints about the noise coming from your room. With the... Oh, come on. You know, it's not that loud. And, you know, Bill was the guy who said, isn't that strange? You just got paid an exorbitant amount of money to play the same notes, and now you're being told to shut up by people who are getting it for free. So I would... Yeah. So this is a tune that I wrote in the Heidi Motel in Pawling, New York, after getting one of those phone calls. Oh, well, because there's no support act, I'll take a break now. That's kind of how this contracts out. If that way it... I'm not sure why it works that way, but it does, and... So I'm going to take a break, and the break is about between 15 and 20 minutes long. And I always point this out. I have, because I still, I've had dreams about this, and where I come back and you don't. So I would, please come back. You don't have to, but you know, it'd be nice of you. Thank you. I'll play this and get off. This is a tune that I wrote for a friend of mine, as it turned out, because I never write them for anything or any reason or anybody. I just try and figure out after I'm done with them what they might, you have to name them something, so you have to come up with that. And fortunately, they do seem to connect somewhere, at least, in my head. And it isn't as random in there as I used to think. So I've been able to trace things. When I was writing this, I suddenly remembered what Seika had told me about her dad, and I had forgotten this for I don't know how many years, but well over 10 years. I met her in Yugoslavia. I used to tour there all the time. Every year I'd go over there at the end of the European leg and play about six cities, and beautiful places in a beautiful country. And each tour would start in Ljubljana, where Seika lived, and where she was a lithographer. She was a lunatic lithographer from Ljubljana, because she would run one litho. And the thing about her and what attracted me to her so much was her explosive temper. She had an incendiary, instant kind of trigger. You can't have that, but I mean, there's no such thing as an incendiary trigger or an instant trigger. She had a trigger that was, she had a hair trigger. There's what I'm looking for. But the thing is, you never knew what was going to set her off. It could be lint blowing by in anything. And boom, and it was great to be around. If you weren't on the, receiving end, you could just watch and, figure this one out, pal. Where you get with this one? It's just incomprehensible. The way she made her lithographs was the perfect example of this, because she would run one litho and then erase the stone. She insisted that she broke the stone. And she gestured, "No, I break the stone. I only print one," which is like having dinner and blowing up the house that you had it in. It was really, really loony. And, when she first told me that, I said, "Well, why do you break the stone?" And she said, "That's none of your business. But I would see her every year in Ljubljana, and I'd hear about the gas crunch and the bliss and that and the other thing. She didn't like it there, and I don't blame her. And one year she showed up and told me that her father had died. I said, she said, "I'll come by the hotel tomorrow and take you into town and show you the things he's done there." And I didn't want to do that, but you can't, what did he do there? You can't say, "No, I don't want to do that. He's dead. Let's forget it." You can't say that to anybody, So the next day we went down to a bridge called Tromostvia. It's a beautiful bridge. It was designed by another guy, but her father, who was an architect and an engineer, built the bridge. And there are three roads, as you may have guessed, and in the course of the bridge they become one road. We were standing at that point when she told me that her father had been arrested, and it was perfectly clear to me why he'd been arrested. And I didn't want to say, "Well, no wonder, look at this bridge. Look how more than the roads merge at the end of the bridge. I think cars merge here and people merge. People who never expected to be so close are now the same stain at the end of your bridge." And I have a temper myself, but I didn't say, "Well, no wonder." Instead, I said, "Well, what'd he do?" when she told me he'd been arrested, and she blew up. I think it's a fairly innocent question when somebody says her dad was arrested. What did he do? Kaboom! And she went on about the system, and she said, you don't have to do anything. He was just arrested, that's all. And we weren't told why he was arrested. We weren't told where he was being kept. We weren't told how long he would be kept. Seika, when she was telling me this story, was still living in the apartment that she'd been born in. She was 29, and her older sister was still living there, and her mother. Their entire lives as a family were spent there. They were living there when her father was arrested. And when her father got home, he'd been in prison for 26 years. They'd written him off for dead, you know, decades earlier. And he had, that's why he came home the year previous to all of this, was to die. They let him out to die. So this guy knocked on the door. Seika answered the door, you know, who's this bum? And her mother recognized him. I can't imagine what that was like. And they sat down, and he told them that he'd been imprisoned all 26 years across the street from that apartment house. He was in a basement cell that had a slit window, and he could look up through the slit window and see Seika and her older sister playing on the balcony. She was 3 years old the first year, and watched them play. Watched them grow up from down there. Oh. Excuse me, I guess that was the right tune. So during the break, we can all go cut our throats. I recorded this with Dr. John Harris, a real doctor. He'd been his license had been revoked, and he'd fallen back on a career as a piano player. Couldn't tell us why his license had been revoked, but we knew why. It wasn't hard. He was in traffic one day driving his car through Mount Juliet, Tennessee. He had Kenny Buttrey in the passenger seat, a drummer. And he stopped at a red light. Excuse me. And while they were waiting for the light to change in heavy traffic, Dr. John got out of the car and walked away. Just left. That's how he played piano. Take you out to this neighborhood you'd never seen before, and you liked it there, and he was sort of showing you around, and then he left you there, lost, no way to get back. And you put it out on your record, you know. It was very strange, because it didn't seem to show the terror and the lostness. John was convinced that people had lived on this earth before we were here, and that they'd left their names on rocks. He was nuts. Best friends I ever had. We were standing out at Quadrifont at a parking lot one night, and I'd had enough of this. People leaving their names on rocks. And I said, because he wouldn't show you the rock, you know? Of course. I said, John, this is it. You know, I know it's late at night, but you know where these rocks are. I don't. Show them to me. And he said, okay. And he leaned over and he picked a piece of gravel up out of the driveway and handed it to me. And I looked at it. Now, that's what I remember about this, is that I looked at it. And I said, you mean they wrote their name on this piece of gravel? He said, yeah. I said, oh, John, there's no... And he leaned over and picked up another rock and handed it to me. And I said, you mean they wrote their name on every rock in this driveway? And he said, yeah. Great, great piano player. another man's love means more to you than the love you stole from me. There's no good in knowing that I want to blame. He's good for you, but let me explain. Already just wait for the change, and we'll be back to you, and it can't be the same. Do this on my own time, really. Well, I'm going to play a couple more things. I want to play one that I recorded in, I wrote it in Australia last year. I go there again the end of this month. I don't know why I go there. I mean, I like it once I'm there, but you could go to the moon in the same amount of time. It takes, it's nuts, really. I thought about taking a boat so that I arrived as a human being, but it takes, a month and a half by boat? And I think you go as a banana or a coconut, you have to get on some kind of freight thing. And I always get in trouble there because I don't know why. There's no because. I went diving there a couple years ago. The tour is always so dense that it takes about a month that I don't really get to dive. You can't fly 24 hours after your last dive, so it's kind of... And most people, when they do dive where the reef is, I dove on the other side off of Perth, where the effluent is, and I was flopping around in the goop and having a great time, you know, because it's still a lot clearer there than it is, you know. I dove in Boston Harbor also. I didn't know what I was doing at the time. And I was following a guy who, it's two people who dove there a lot and knew the place, and we found a cave, and this cave was, you know, it was a cave, and it was, you go in there, and this one had a hole at the back end with some light coming through it, and oh boy, a hole, and you run up to the hole. I mean, it wouldn't mean anything on dry land, you'd just walk right past it, but underwater, whoopee, let's go through the hole. So swim up to the hole, and the guy, she has taken off, she went somewhere else, and the guy swims through the hole, and yay, here I come, and I'm heading up to the hole, and the closer I get to the hole, the smaller the hole gets. But he was bigger than I was, and and boom, and I crammed myself in the hole and got stuck because the hole was too small. And I was really stuck, you know. I could move about like this, a little bit sideways, and that was it. I mean, that was it. I could wave back here. So I was hey. And it occurred to me, I'm plugging the only source of light they had in that cave back there. This is invisible, this hand. And then you start to think, and I wondered, what if he doesn't even notice I'm not behind him anymore? What if, does he even like me, you know? I didn't know him that well. And there you are. I mean, it's you know, I got out, obviously. He found me, and he had to, you know, feel along, just kind of grope. What I figured out was, in the time that I had, and I had too much time to think, was that how did this happen? Well, he'd just gone up to the hole, blocked the light, and swum on into the black on the other side of it. It looked like he went through the hole. Here comes the American now. That's what a nut. Last year I was sitting in my room on the couch with this guitar. I looked down and the room had flooded. I'm afloat in Sydney. So I wrote this. It's called Snorkel. Thank you.
Yes.
Sound. I did say I was playing two things, but I wasn't. That was it. That was kind of like the end with that sort of milky song. I'm the guy who didn't marry pretty Lamb of the Ground, educated, well intentioned, good girl in our town. And I wonder where I'd be today if she had loved me too. Probably be driving kids to school. And I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town. And I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Lights of cities, and I've been inside the door. Sailed a foreign country and walked upon their shore. And I guess the guy she married was the best part of my luck. She dug him 'cause he drove a pickup truck. And I guess I owe it all to Pamela. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town. And I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Everything it takes to get a guy like me in love. And Lord, I hope she's happy, 'cause she sure deserves to be, especially for what she did for me. And I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Guess I